I'm JG Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Before we get to this edition of the show, I just want to promote Wall Street Window, a website maintained by Mike Swanson that provides valuable insights on both financial markets and geopolitics. It's been around since 2003, and its slogan is "Be in the Know," and I highly recommend it as daily reading. So go on over to wallstreetwindow.com and keep yourself informed. This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, Bert, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace, Nick,
Meresham,
Galen, Arlen, Beau, Gigadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan,
David H, Y Kellerman, Sade 13,
Kathleen, David,
Ava,
Bob,
The West Bank Robbery Podcast,
Jamie,
Enoch,
Gary,
Max,
Ishtofer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho,
Brian,
Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we've got a double feature for you. Later on in the show, we'll be speaking with law professor Richard Abel, author of the book How Autocrats Seek Power, Resisting Trump and Trumpism. It's his third book in a trilogy on the issue of autocracy and autocrats. But before we get to that, I'm going to be speaking with Kieran Dolan, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who heads up that institute's Criminalization of Race and Poverty Project. Kieran joins us to discuss the policies of Joe Biden heading into the election season and the differences between his policies on economics when compared to his policies on, say, the border or Gaza. All that and more in the conversation to follow with Kieran Dolan. Welcome to Parallax Views. The guest that I'm very interested to be speaking with, Kieran Dolan, is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and we're going to be talking about a few recent articles she's written, including Biden's populist budget marks the overdue end of trickle-down economics, and the reason I initially got in contact with her. Her piece entitled Parsing Biden's 2024 State of the Union Address. How are you doing?
I'm well, JG. Nice to be with you.
So in this election season that we're getting into now, where do you think we should start? What are the issues you think that matters the most right now?
I think we want to look at what is the kind of future we want for ourselves, for our children, for our grandchildren. And what are the policies that will get us to the place where all of us are thriving, where the planet is secure, where people around the world aren't dying, where hunger is solved at home and abroad? I think those are the kinds of issues, those are the values that we all hold that should be driving our decisions.
In regards to the article you wrote on The Hill, Biden's populist budget marks the overdue end of trickle-down economics. Maybe you could just go into the outlines of that piece you wrote for The Hill, because I thought it was a very interesting look at Bidenomics.
Yes, I think Biden, more than any previous modern president has been taking on this popular economics agenda, similar to some of the values we'd heard expressed by progressive politicians like Bernie Sanders, where they're talking about what is the best way for families, children, communities, the earth to thrive, as opposed to what we have heard from both parties, from the major parties, Republican and Democrat, in the past decades, of this idea of trickle-down economics, and whereby you are giving massive tax breaks to the very wealthiest and the most profitable corporations, with a false idea that somehow that huge windfall for the rich is going to trickle down and help lift all the rest of us. But we know that that's not true. We have 50 years of studies and data to show that that isn't true. And I think that hearing President Biden express that fact so clearly and with those words was a welcome breath of air for the rest of us who aren't.
Yeah, I think he said in the State of the Union speech, the days of trickle-down economics are over. I think those were his exact words, but go on.
That's what he said. And I think that that should be music to the ears of most of us.
Can we break down the numbers? I know that you do a lot of work in relation to inequities in America. And you're the project director for IPS's project on criminalization of race and poverty. Maybe you could just give the basic statistics when it comes to issues of inequity related to race and especially poverty and class.
Well, we know that homelessness is unforgivably high in the United States. We know that maternal death rates are higher than other industrialized nations. We know that food insecurity among children is on the rise. So these have been very stark inequalities that affect disproportionately women, children, BIPOC people, people of color, tribal nations. But we should also remember that the vast majority of people who are poor in this country are white, and they're also affected by these inequities. So when you try to put that in context of the United States being the wealthiest nation in the world, those are confusing things to put together. Why do we have so much homelessness? Why do we have children that go to bed hungry? Why are our schools falling apart? Why are our bridges falling apart? Why is there lead in the water? You know, these things shouldn't be happening in a wealthy country. The reason that they are helping, I would contend, is because of misplaced federal priorities.
Can you maybe elaborate on that?
Yes. So we've seen one of the budget debates between the two major parties. What we've seen in the last several years, well, the last several decades, but if we go back to 2017, when Donald Trump was in the presidency, he and the Republicans passed a whopping tax bill that benefited only the wealthy. There have been estimates that, and they were not paid for. In other words, there were no revenues to come in to offset that cost to the budget. And the estimates are between over $2 trillion and $5 trillion costs to the American people just for these wealthy tax cuts that benefit a very tiny fraction of the U.S. Population over the next 10 years. Whereas if you look at the budget that Joe Biden just put forward, his budget proposal, which is not, it's not legislation, Congress has to pass legislation, but the president's budget every year is an expression of values. And in that, he has detailed the ways that we can raise 5.3 trillion in revenues rather than sucking that money away from the American people, away from the programs that we all care about. He is proposing ways to raise 5.3 trillion in revenues in order to invest almost 2.5 trillion in us, in the American people. And he would raise that money by imposing fair taxes on the very wealthiest. So what we have seen from, at least from the Bush, from the, well, Bush had tax cuts for the rich as well, but from the Trump tax cuts on, is that we have seen a draining of resources from the American people to line the pockets of the very wealthy. The one exception is what happened during the pandemic. And I think that what happened during the pandemic is very instructive for us. So we went into the pandemic already with some, you know, with limited resources and these inequities that we've already talked about. Faced with plunging employment, in other words, spiking unemployment rates, with people losing their jobs, with people being sick, with people dying, with people unable to catch up with their rent, facing eviction, with food insecurity spiking, with child poverty going up. Congress, and I don't mean to be partisan here, but you can look at the records. For the American Rescue Plan, it was only Democrats who voted in favor of the American Rescue Plan package. And that's the only reason it passed. And that gave us stimulus payments. It gave us, most importantly, the increase in the child tax credit. That helped 40 million families in the United States. It helped nearly everybody who needed help. So that the tax credit was not only increased, but it was given to families monthly rather than annually, which is how it usually works. When families that are facing job loss, hardship, that are struggling to get by, when they receive that payment monthly, they're able to keep up on their rent. They're able to not fall behind on utility bills, on cell phone bills. If the car breaks down, they're able to fix the car. If the child needs new shoes for school, they're able to do that. And what we saw as a result of that was child poverty being cut in half. So that is an illustration of what we can do when we invest robustly in American families rather than taking funds away in order to give them to the wealthy.
When it comes to, I wanted to talk about two separate issues, maybe the misperceptions people have about both issues. And the first issue was the issue of taxation, and especially taxation of the ultra wealthy. What do you think people have to understand about taxing the wealthy, and what do you think are some of the arguments that need to be knocked down when it comes to people arguing, if we tax the wealthy, they'll just move their business elsewhere? I think these are the kind of arguments we hear from people that don't want higher taxation on the wealthy. Maybe you can push back on those arguments.
Yes, I think that we can all understand that corporations don't want to pay taxes.
Right.
So the threat is, if I have to pay taxes like everyone else, I'm going to move my companies. And of course, a lot of corporations do that. They park their corporations and their profits in countries with lower tax rates. However, that is, again, that's taking investments out of our country. That's something where then we don't have the money to invest in roads, in bridges, in water, in schools, and all of the things that we value. Now, for the corporations in the United States, many of them are getting away with murder, figuratively speaking, in terms of not paying any taxes at all. You and I have to pay taxes. We don't get away with paying no taxes at all. You know, the average person on the street doesn't get away with paying no taxes at all. And if you want to hear, just recently, at the Institute for Policy Studies, my colleagues, along with Americans for Tax Justice, Tax Fairness, put out a study where they look at the corporations who are not only not paying any taxes, they're getting tax refunds. Meanwhile, they're paying their CEOs exorbitant amounts of money. So for one example, Tesla. They have a 5-year executive pay that adds up to $2.5 billion. 5-year US profit, $4.5 billion. 5-year federal income tax, -$1 million. Negative. T-Mobile, same thing. They have a -$80 million. Netflix, they are paying $236 million over 5 years, but that's on a profit of $15.1 billion. So I think anybody can understand the unfairness of that when you
Especially when
are.
you look at the numbers themselves, like you just
That's
did.
right. When you really look at the numbers, the billions of dollars in profit and the millions to billions in CEO pay. And then you realize that so many of these companies are paying nothing, and in some cases, taking advantage of tax loopholes that need to be closed. They're taking advantage of loopholes that you and I don't have the advantage to take. And they're receiving refunds, which is really our money. Now, another thing to look at that is sucking our money is the Pentagon budget. So the Pentagon budget is, $1 trillion per year. At the same time, the proposals are to cut things that have helped us, the child tax credit, the, education funding, food programs, nutrition programs, childcare, Pell grants, infrastructure, climate, green energy, you name it, any program that is beneficial to us. There is a strong push from many wealthy donors, corporations, ultra conservatives to cut the programs that benefit us in order to more and more and more line the pockets of the wealthy. So Biden has proposed some very modest tax reforms for the people who are currently getting away with paying little to nothing or getting unjustly our tax money. Same thing with the Pentagon. Why are we spending that much there? So the average taxpayer, we're spending $5,000 per year of our tax money to corporate, to the arms producers, to defense contractors who are making huge profits. Why do I have to subsidize them? So there's another resource for your readers on our website, the Institute for Policy Studies, that we have a project called the National Priorities Project, and they just released today a tax receipt where you can see where your tax dollars go and how they could instead be invested in things that we need, like housing, food, education. It's a matter of priorities.
If you could, the second thing I wanted to ask you about, and I know that you only mentioned this briefly in the analysis of Biden's State of the Union address, but I know there's a lot of people that are talking about inflation lately, even though, as you know, it's US inflation is far lower than in Germany, the United Kingdom, and France, and is coming down faster. Can you talk about the concerns over inflation and then maybe
the concerns that we're not seeing enough of about corporate price gouging.
Well, I think that that's the key. What you just said is corporate price gouging. And I think Biden even himself made a reference to it in his State of the Union address, where he said, you'll notice you're going to, buy a bag of chips and it's only half full, but the price has gone up 15 cents. Or, the Snickers bar might cost the same, but it's 25% smaller. And this is not a result of the supply chain problems that we had during the pandemic. There were supply chain problems during the pandemic. Those have largely been resolved. However, the corporations have not brought down the prices, even though inflation itself is coming down and is less and less year over year. When we go into the supermarket, the companies who have jacked up their prices and are lobbying the profits that they're getting, their profits are going up and up, and our wallets are going down and down. And we're not looking at the culprit, which is corporate price gouging. Instead, we're interpreting it as inflation, even as the US's level of inflation is far lower than other countries. So I think what we need to do is really look behind the headlines. Why is that happening? There's no reason that a bag of potato chips should be half full and you're paying 50 cents more for the bag. There's no reason for that except corporate price gouging. And if your readers want to get some citations on that, all they have to do is Google corporate price gouging in the US in 2023, 2024, 2022. And you can see the reports that back up that this is what's happened.
In regards to Biden's State of the Union, where do you think he may be falling short when it comes to the progressive base that maybe supports some of these economic policies domestically, but may have issues with some of Biden's other policies?
Yes, that's really important, JG. Never mind progressive points of view, but just a human points of view, just humanitarian reasons. I think that two places where most people, at least polls will say so, vastly disagree with President Biden is on Gaza. People may be encouraged by some of his recent rhetoric, where he's insisting that the Israel government needs to allow in humanitarian aid. They need to protect citizens more. They need to have a plan before they invade Rafah that there's some way to protect, the 1.5 million people forced in like sardines to that area. But that remains rhetoric until he stops sending weapons. You can say that out of one side of your mouth, but you're sending the bombs that are killing these people. You're sending the weapons. Whereas the American public polls across the board, I mean, more so among Democrats and independents, but also large numbers of Republicans don't like to see this slaughter, and that our tax dollars are supporting it. When we were talking before about what happens with our tax dollars, well, one of the jobs of this massive Pentagon machine is that we're funding the very bombs and fighter jets that are killing tens of thousands of innocent Gazans. So I think that that's wildly out of step. And then the other place where I think that President Biden is also wildly out of step is his rhetoric around immigrants. Most people in this country, and polls will back it up, believe that immigration and people who've immigrated to the country are important to the fabric of our nation. Diversity is important to the fabric of our nation. Our children going to school with all kinds of kids and being exposed to all kinds of cultures is important. Our frontline workers are immigrants. We know, so many millions of us are immigrants ourselves. Our families are immigrants. we have a sense of decency and humanity. And I think that when President Biden talks about immigration at the southern border, he leaves out the humanitarian aspect of it, and he ignores what the vast majority of us are saying. On top of that, from a practical point of view, the Congressional Budget Office scored that if we restrict immigration, we stand to lose about $7 trillion in GDP in the next 10 years. So not only is immigration vital to us as a society, as people, as the kind of nation, a community, neighborhoods we want, immigration is vital to our economy. It's vital to our well-being economically, as well as psychologically and as thriving human beings.
Before we start closing out, is there anywhere on domestic policy that more progressively minded people may argue that Biden is falling short on? Or where do you just think domestic policy, especially economic policy, has to move going forward? Can it be pushed further?
Yes, well, I think one place where that's very clear is with regard to green energy. So Biden has gotten a lot of credit, and in some instances, rightly so, for some of his green energy policies in the infrastructure bill specifically. But if you look at the details in that, there's still a lot of green energy programs that are conditioned on expansion of the fossil fuel industry. So I don't know. I think that people are missing. They're looking at the headlines, but whether the headlines are good or bad, regardless of what party it is, read the bill, go behind it, really look at what that's saying. He should be banning exports of crude oil. He should not allow expansion of fossil fuel. You can't really say you're addressing climate change by funding some green energy programs, but they're contingent upon expanding fossil fuels. So I think that is one area that we really, really need some pressure on, whichever party is in power. And just finally, economically, again, I mentioned earlier how important the child tax credit expanded, made monthly, and made refundable all the way down to the people who are the poorest in our country. Right now, the poorest people, the ones who need it the most, don't receive the child tax credit. That may be a surprise to a lot of people. Joe Biden has proposed that restoring the expanded tax credit during the pandemic to restore our current child tax credit and earned income tax credit programs to those expanded levels in his budget. Right now, there is a tax bill in Congress that would expand it somewhat, and it would help an extra 16 million people. But remember, the people that were helped during the pandemic were 40 million families. So I think that if we really want to address poverty, we should all be pressuring and demanding that we want the full pandemic era expanded child tax credit, and then the earned income tax credit for adults, low-income adults who don't have dependent children at home. When you get the two of those together, that's very important. And one other thing I would mention, that people should also look at what are the conservatives proposing. They are proposing cutting Medicare, cutting Social Security, cutting Medicaid, cutting all of the social programs I just talked about, cutting Pell Grants, cutting education. Cut, and not little cuts, massive cuts. But why? So that they will have that money to extend Trump's tax cuts. So look at the values. Do we want to be a nation that simply lines the pockets of the wealthy, or do we want to be a nation that invests in families and communities and the planet?
Well, Karen, I think that's a great note to end on. Is there anything I missed or anything you want to go over here just in the last minute or so that I didn't get to? And how can my listeners keep up with your work?
I think you were very thorough, JG. So I don't have anything to add. People can look at our website, ips-dc.org, for a lot of the studies that I mentioned today in the podcast. And they could follow me on Twitter/X at Karen Dolan. And thank you so much for having me.
Next up, UCLA law professor Richard Abel joins me to discuss his latest book, How Autocrats Seek Power: Resisting Trump and Trumpism. We'll be discussing a lot of different issues, but this book in particular hones in on the events of January 6th and the lead up to that moment. We'll be discussing what autocracy is, and we'll get into it a little bit over the US's support of certain autocratic states that are considered allies to American interests. I think this is a good conversation. It's not really a debate. I have in the past voiced skepticism over trying to talk about the world in terms of freedom versus autocracy. I think there's a lot of states that we support that are autocratic. And I think we need to self-reflect on that as Americans. However, I think this is a really interesting conversation, and it gets at some really important points about various issues related to autocracy and concerns many have over a second Trump presidency. So, without any further ado, let's get right to it with Richard Abel. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I'm very happy to be speaking with. Richard Abel is Michael J. Connell Distinguished Professor of Law Emeritus and Distinguished Research Professor at UCLA, and he's the author of a trilogy of books about autocracy and Trump. The previous two books were How Autocrats Abuse Power, Resistance to Trump and Trumpism, and How Autocrats Attack Expertise, Resistance to Trump and Trumpism. The latest book, released on March 26th, is How Autocrats Seek Power, Resistance to Trump and Trumpism. How are you doing?
I'm well. Let me just correct the pronunciation of my last name. It's Abel, not Abel.
Oh, I'm sorry. My apologies. So maybe you could give a little bit of your background. You have a very interesting background involving writing about South African apartheid and whatnot. And you even have a book that was prefaced, I believe, by Nelson Mandela.
Well, I'm happy to do that. And let me start by saying, of course, I'm very proud and honored by Mandela's preface. And therefore, I'm appalled by the fact that Trump has said, I am ready to go to jail in defiance of Judge Merchan's gag order, just like Nelson Mandela. I can't think of two people who are less alike than Mandela, who spent 27 years in prison in service of the struggle against apartheid, and Trump, who is openly racist. His most recent comments are, why don't we have more immigrants from Denmark, Norway, and Switzerland? Why do we have to have them from countries like Yemen? So let me give you some background about how these books came about, and I'm happy to start with the South African experience. So I went to South Africa three or four times in the late 80s and early 90s, before the transition to apartheid, before the transition to democracy. And my concern was to try to understand the ways in which law, lawyers, and the legal system assisted the struggle against apartheid. That was a triumphant story. It was really an extraordinary success. And what Mandela writes in the preface is that it was the fidelity to law and the rule of law that permitted a peaceful transition to a democratic society. Okay, so I wrote that book. Then I was struck by the fact, let me tell the story the following way. In May 2004, I was driving back from the Grand Canyon. It's a long, straight stretch through the desert on I-10. And I was listening to a Weekend Edition on NPR, which was interviewing Seymour Hersh, who had just broken the story of Abu Ghraib in a series of New Yorker articles. Well, I was struck by that, as millions of Americans were, but I had a personal interest because Tsai had broken the story of My Lai 30 years earlier, which had a powerful effect on ending the Vietnam War. And Tsai's my brother-in-law. So I've been following Tsai's investigative reporting now for all of my life and much of his. So I decided that I had to write a book about whether or not America, confronting a threat from the atrocious 9/11 attacks, was going to preserve the rule of law in fighting it, what it called its war on terror. Those were very depressing books because, in fact, the government betrayed the rule of law in multiple ways. One, which just is in the paper again today, by imprisoning over 800 people in Guantanamo without trial indefinitely, 20 of whom remain, even though many of those have been certified eligible for release. So that was a very depressing book. Those books were completed in 2018. And I went on the road to publicize them at various law schools. And I typically got a question during the Q&A, you've written a book about the Bush administration, a book about the Obama administration. Surely now, 2018, you're going to write a book about the Trump administration. To which I replied, it's a very different animal, the Trump administration. It has no fidelity to the rule of law whatsoever. I don't think I'm going to do that. But I never stopped taking notes and reading everything I could about what was happening. And at the end of 2020, actually just before the January 6th insurrection, I looked back over those notes and realized I did have a story to tell. And indeed, I'll say it modestly, I think it's the most important story I've ever told. Because, and I'll stop here to ask, let you get a word in edgewise. I think that the threat to American democracy in 2024, in the election that's coming up, is an existential threat. It's the greatest threat of mine more than 80 years. And I think that if Trump is reelected, the ability of the country to restore democracy after his final second term will be severely impaired.
I have a two-part question for you. And this is very important to me because I don't think we should overlook the Bush and Obama administrations and what we saw during the war on terror, especially at a moment like this where the Middle East is back in the news. What do you think? Well, what were your criticisms of the Bush and Obama administration? But then why do you consider those administrations different than Trump?
Okay. My criticisms were multifold. I wrote about the following issues, and these were chapters. The two books are called Law's Wars and Law's Trials. And they dealt with the following issues, among others. They dealt, obviously, with the imprisonment in Guantanamo. And there, the legal system really failed. The Supreme Court declared that the Guantanamo detainees had a right to habeas corpus. They brought the habeas corpus petitions in the district court in D.C. They won many of those petitions, and they were reversed on partisan party lines by the District of Columbia Circuit Court. So that was an unhappy story. I wrote about torture. There was no question but that detainees were tortured. Most recently, this was being discussed in Lithuania because they still have the prison where the torture occurred, but also in Guantanamo, in Abu Ghraib, and in other places. And there's actually a case that is going to be heard in the Circuit Court in D.C., now brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights, challenging that torture. But it's 20 years, and it's a long time to bring that challenge. I wrote about electronic surveillance, which Edward Snowden had exposed, and which was mammoth in its extent. And Congress is about to revote authorization for those forms of electronic surveillance. I wrote about civil liberties violations, and there were multiple violations. For instance, the roundup of hundreds, indeed thousands, of people with Arab last names, again, detained without trial and often deported with no due process. So indeed, in most of those respects, the efforts to preserve basic rule of law principles were largely unsuccessful, but the courts adhere to those principles, and neither the president nor Congress denounced them. In fact, Congress passed a law outlawing torture. So The evils of those two administrations were egregious. They deserve condemnation. That's why I wrote the books. But the system, by and large, responded. We have remedial mechanisms. We have corrective mechanisms. We have the separation of powers. And we had someone like John McCain, who had himself suffered years of torture in Vietnam and who became a strong anti-torture advocate. You don't have that kind of party line crossing today. The Republican Party has basically pledged its fidelity to Trump, who possesses so much power with his grassroots that people are terrified. Republicans in Congress are terrified of being primaried and basically have kissed the ring. Mitch McConnell, who has said he's going to, has said, first he said, I will never speak to that man again after January 6th. Then, but now he says, he is going to vote for Trump, even though he's not worried about being primary because he's going to leave Congress at the end of his term.
I think that leads into my next question, which is, so this trilogy of books you have, it's all about autocrats. And I hope this doesn't sound like a dumb question, but maybe we should deal with what is an autocrat? What is autocracy?
Not a dumb question at all, because it's not a term that was in play really until the last couple of years, because we believed in America that we were exempt from the threat of autocracy. We know of its existence in other countries, Russia, China, Hungary probably today, Venezuela, Cuba. I mean, there are plenty of countries you can name that are clearly autocratic, but we, with a history of more than 200 years of democracy, thought we were exempt from all of that. An autocrat is a leader, typically the chief executive, who believes he, and I'll use the word, the gender term, because I think they're all at the moment men and have been historically, who believes he's exempt from any kind of constraint on his power, doesn't believe in separation of powers, doesn't believe in the courts, doesn't even believe that he's responsible to a legislature, believes that his power is absolute. And Trump has said that. He said, jokingly, he says, on day one, I'm going to be a dictator. But a dictator on day one is likely to be a dictator on day two and for all of the 4 years that follow it. And he has said that in moments of crisis, which he claims we are in now, the president is not bound by regulations, is not bound by laws, and indeed is not bound by the Constitution. That's an autocrat. So for me, the reason for writing these books is that I wanted to see whether the self-corrective mechanisms that have stood us in such good stead over 200 years are still viable. My qualified answer is they have been, because Trump did not achieve what he hoped to achieve during his 4 years, and I hope they will be again in two ways. First, of course, to stop him from being elected, and two, if he is elected, to prevent him from doing his worst.
With regards to one of the most important aspects of this book, I wanted to talk about January 6th. I think we saw the images, the riots, the insurrection. What do you think the most important points are to understand about January 6th, and maybe take us through the nitty-gritty of the case? Because I think a lot of people focus on the images they saw that day, and they may not have all the details about how it all played out.
Okay. First, I would say that the January 6th special committee, which was appointed by Congress, did, I think, a superb job. I watched all the hearings. I've read the transcript. I've read the reports. They really, I think, presented a very effective case. And some of the testimony was riveting. When Cassidy Hutchinson talks about the ways in which Trump tried to get himself to the Capitol that day, ordering the Secret Service to take him there, and they defied him because they felt they couldn't protect him. Or the two black election workers from Georgia who talked about the threats and the reason they had to flee their houses when they refused to do the bidding and insisted on counting votes. Okay, the events themselves were truly horrifying. More than 1,350 people have been charged with those events, and several hundred more are almost certain to be charged in the months that follow. of those one, that is the largest criminal prosecution of around a single event in American history. It was an extraordinary thing to do. It totally overwhelmed the DC court, which never heard that many criminal cases in a year in any of its history. Of those 1,350 cases, there have been only two acquittals. I'm going to repeat that. Two acquittals. That's extraordinary. We know that in general, criminal cases are successful. Most criminal defendants plead out. But that level of success is again unprecedented. What I find even more interesting, and I'm documenting this in my fourth book, which I'm in the process of writing and which I'll complete right after Election Day this year, which is called How Autocrats Are Held Accountable. I looked not only at what the outcomes of those cases were, but the very interesting data, which was reported extensively in the Washington Post, about the oral statements that the judges of the DC district made in the course of handing down sentences. So during the sentencing procedure, the defendant has an opportunity to speak to the judge, to admit error, to beg for mercy, whatever, and the judge has an obligation to say something about why he or she is passing sentence. So two things about that. First of all, let me go back a step. What I did in the three books about the Trump administration, as in the two books about the war on terror, was to pose and answer the following question. Federal judges at all three levels of the federal judiciary, the Supreme Court, the Courts of Appeal, and the district courts, do federal judges, in deciding these highly fraught political cases, do they decide along party lines? So I used as a surrogate measure of the judge's own political persuasion, the party of the president appointing him or her, which is, I think, a 99% ballot index. And then I asked, was the judge voting in favor of the administration or voting to curtail the administration because of the Constitution or other aspects of legality? In the war on terror cases, the correlation was 0.01. I'm sorry, 0.01. That's less than the 0.05 probability that statisticians use to test significance. It's a very high level of correlation. In the 4 years of the Trump administration, in three areas, cases challenging Trump's administration, immigration actions, cases challenging what the Trump administration did about the pandemic, and most of all, cases about the 2020 election. In those three areas, I ran the same correlations. The probability in this case was 0.00001. For the non-statisticians, that's the likelihood of that happened by chance is 1 in 100,000. That's an extraordinary degree of correlation of statistical significance. That's all a preface to the fact that with respect to the criminal cases brought against the January 6th defendants, there was no statistically significant correlation. That is, there was no significant difference between Republican judges and Democratic judges. And that's extraordinary. That's the first part of it. The second part of it is, I looked to see what the judges, both Republican and Democrat, were saying, but especially the Republican judges, and they were outraged by the actions of January 6th. I can think of several reasons for this. One, of course, is that the courthouse is 2 blocks away from the Capitol. And as far as I know, the court was in session that day. So they may have been evacuated in the afternoon, but they were, this was happening contemporaneously. Second of all, the defendants were not their usual defendants. The District of Columbia has a large non-white population, and those are the people we know who tend to come before criminal courts. In this case, almost all of the defendants were white. They were tended to be rather to be older, often in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and maybe even older, almost exclusively male, many of them with backgrounds in the police and the military, and often with good employment records and well educated. So the judges felt, these are people like us. Why are they doing these things? And many of them were simply defiant. Some, at least one of them, confessed error, begged for mercy. The judge sentenced him, and he said, "That's all bullshit. I still believe everything that Trump did, and these proceedings were a farce." So you can imagine that after that, judges took some of those confessions of error less seriously. I was really struck strongly by that. And what the judges said was, this was the most fundamental attack on American democracy that we've ever seen, something I entirely agree with, and we are going to sentence these people. In fact, the sentences were not all that harsh. They were roughly half what was requested by the prosecution, roughly half of the recommended sentences under the guidelines. But nevertheless, the judges made a point in their sentencing statements that these were serious crimes and they needed to be dealt with seriously.
How important do you think it is for people to understand the pre-January 6th events that happened with regards to the Trump administration, specifically the Electoral College skullduggery, the the last ditch effort, as you put it, in Georgia before the January 6th insurrection? Take us through that. How important is that, those pre-January 6th moments?
Well, at some point we may hear that in a courtroom, which of course is where it belongs, because both sides will have an opportunity to present evidence, to cross-examine adverse witnesses, and we will have a jury deciding the verdict, and then a judge sentencing. So that we hope will happen in Georgia in Fulton County. At the moment, in that case, although Nicholas Wade has recused himself from the prosecution, Judge McAfee has continued the prosecution, and Fannie Willis is still hoping to go forward with it. Similarly, in the District of Columbia, Judge Chutkan has said she wants to go forward with the case that Jack Smith has brought. So we have two courts, one a state court, one a federal court, one in Atlanta, one in D.C., that will be deciding these issues. And we won't know how they come out. And of course, I'm coming back to the core of this, but my great fear is that if Trump is reelected, at least in the case of the federal court, I think that case will disappear because he will appoint an attorney general. The attorney general will try to end that case. At the very least, I'm not sure whether they can fire Jack Smith as special prosecutor, but they can starve him of money. They can basically deprive him of funds. And I don't think there's anything that can be done about that. But the Georgia case can proceed, although, of course, it's been impaired by the recent events there. Okay, the facts of the case themselves. Well, there's no question about what Trump said to Raffensperger on that hour-long phone call. It was recorded. Nobody's contesting the fact of the recording. The transcript is available. It's been published. And what Trump said to him is, find me 11,780 votes, because that's what I need to get the electoral votes of Georgia. And Raffensperger said, no, I can't do that. We don't do the things that way. Even though Raffensperger is a lifelong Republican, a member of the Federalist Society. No, I take that back. A lifelong Republican. And although he opposed Trump, he is now entirely backing him once again. So I think in the Georgia case, they really have Trump, pinned to the ground. And I would expect that a court will hear that case and will take it seriously. In the D.C. case, it's much more complicated. It is the words of Trump, especially on January 6th itself. The call to be there will be wild that he made a month earlier. And then his statement, we've got to fight. If you don't fight, we will lose the republic. I'm going to follow you to the Capitol, etc. If that's not a call to arms and a call to disrupt the proceedings, there's no other reason to go to the Capitol for a proceeding that was in fact simply a rubber stamp. The Electoral College had voted, and the certification process was simply to certify what the Electoral College had done. To Mike Pence's credit, and I'm no fan of Mike Pence, he did the only thing that he could possibly do. He was advised that way by his own counsel, Greg Jacob, and also by Michael Luddig, for whom John Eastman had clerked in the Small World Department. John Eastman advocating that Pence could, in fact, simply annul the election and send it back to the states, and Luddick saying that was simply not true. So I think in both cases, what was done both in the phone call and then in the call to overturn the election during the certification proceedings and indeed to disrupt those proceedings. I think those are clearly the most fundamental violations of democracy, and that Trump deserves to be tried for them. Trump's own words have made it clear that the only elections he cares about are the elections he wins. And he has said, I will accept the results if I win. And he has said, if I don't win, there'll be no more elections.
So the next question I had, and I hope this isn't taken as like an overly critical question, but you mentioned a number of states that can be defined as autocracies. A few of these states, though, are U.S. allies. So, for instance, Turkey, I would say India, Qatar, Saudi Arabia. Does resisting autocracy entail that maybe we do need, as the United States, to reassess our relations with countries that are autocratic that we consider allies?
I think the answer is a flat, and it's not too harsh a question, but I think the answer is a flat no. After Putin was accused with overwhelming evidence of having ordered the assassinations of Russians abroad, Trump said, "We have no moral ground to criticize Russia. After all, we kill people as well." I think that's r ridiculous. There's no moral equivalence between the United States and Russia, between the United States and Turkey, between the United States and Qatar, or any of those countries. The United States is deeply flawed. I say that in my books, and I've participated in the criticism of those flaws. I did it in my books about the war on terror. Right after I graduated from law school, I went down south and worked as a civil rights lawyer. I've been a legal aid lawyer briefly. I am as critical, I think, as anybody in legal academia of the record of American democracy. But it remains a democracy, which means that there are corrective mechanisms. It's those that I want to preserve.
No, I agree with that. I more so meant, should the US also be critical of these ally states that, I mean, like Turkey is considered an ally. I still think we should be critical of them, though, because they're autocratic. Do you think that's fair?
One can answer that question on grounds of basic morality, where I think the answer would be yes, and then on grounds of strategy. How effective are those criticisms going to be? And I'm afraid that in many instances, American public criticisms by, let's say, a president of an autocrat in another country is just going to strengthen the support of that autocrat at home, which is not what we want to do. It's a very hard question about what the United States should be doing to foster democracy abroad, because we have a terrible record of the CIA supporting autocrats when it's in our interest in doing so. So other countries are rightly suspicious of American statements about their own politics. So there, I leave that question to the diplomats about what is the most effective way.
I appreciate that. That's a very straight answer. In terms of your greatest concerns, what do you see as the what are your biggest fears with regards to what could happen with this next election?
There are all sorts of possible scenarios. Let's suppose that Trump, make the easiest, Trump wins an outright electoral college victory, regardless of what the popular vote is. Then he will be, Biden has made it clear that, of course, he will acknowledge an electoral victory. We won't have another January 6th. There will be a certification and Trump will take office. I'll come back to that in a second, because then the question is, what can he do in office, which is an important question. There is at least one other possibility, which is the following. We now know that RFK Jr. is running with now a chosen vice presidential candidate, and there are at least two or three other third-party candidates. If neither of the two major parties achieves a majority in the Electoral College, then, as I understand it, the Congress will have to make a decision, and the decision will be based on one vote per state. Another bizarre aspect of the undemocratic nature of American elections because it gives equal power to Wyoming and California, despite the enormous differences in population. And Republicans control an estimated 26 at least of the 50 states. So then they will seat Trump. And that will be a result that will be contested by many people, at least in terms of legitimacy, if not violently. And there will be considerable concern about whether or not Trump has been rightly elected. But now let's turn to Trump in power, because that is a real possibility. He has said what he's going to do. He said on day one, I'm going to be a dictator. And there's every reason to think he'll be a dictator on every day that follows. He has said, I don't feel that I'm bound by law. He has made immigration the centerpiece of his campaign. He has repeatedly referred to immigrants as animals. He has said they are polluting the blood of the nation, a phrase which is eerily reminiscent of Nazi ideology and Hitler's own rhetoric. He said just yesterday, apparently, why don't we let people in from Switzerland and from Denmark and from Norway rather than from places like Yemen where everybody's blowing each other up? Well, the reason is people in Norway and Sweden and Denmark are very happy where they are, and they have no desire to come to America. Their countries are working well, their governments are democratic, they're living well, they have social services, et cetera. And the people of Yemen have been fighting a catastrophic civil war for decades, and they, like the people of Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, much of sub-Saharan Africa, Venezuela, I could go on and on, are desperate to leave. And that desperation is only going to increase for, among other reasons, but may actually primarily because of climate change. We are just beginning to see the effects of climate change, and every reputable scientist assures us they are going to get worse. So people are going to be fleeing starvation. They're going to have no choice. And they will do anything, including climbing aboard rubber boats to sail across the Mediterranean when people die every day in huge numbers. Trump thinks he can simply stop that. He says, I'm going to close the border on day one. Well, his wall, he only built about 500 miles of it. And even that is highly penetrable. You can go under it, you can go over it. And the rest of the border is porous, as he says. And it's porous because these are desperate people. They have nowhere else to go. They are literally dying. So he's not going to be able to close the border. And legally, he can't do that. We are bound by treaties, which he cannot unilaterally dismiss, which require that we hear asylum petitions, and many of these people have legitimate claims for asylum, and the legitimacy of those claims is only going to increase with time. So that's what he's going to try to do. During his first administration, all but one of his executive actions on immigration was struck down. He had to use executive actions because he didn't control both houses of Congress. My hope is that even if Trump wins the presidency, Democrats will retain at least one house of Congress, and he will be in the same predicament. So the court struck down all but one of those executive actions. The court struck down his challenges to the election. The courts struck down efforts to block pandemic preventive precautions. Do I have a faith that courts will continue to do that? Well, again, I gave you the correlations. Republican judges tend to support the administration. Democratic judges tend to support the rule of law and the Constitution. Trump proudly sought to pack the Supreme Court. He said notoriously, even if you don't like me, you've got to vote for me because I'm going to appoint the most pro-choice, I'm sorry, the most anti-choice justice to the Supreme Court. And indeed, Amy Coney Barrett is exactly that justice. And Mitch McConnell said the same thing. What he said toward the end of Trump's term is, even if the Democrats get into power, I personally have filled the courts with enough Federalists that they will not be able to change the composition of the courts. So we are dependent on the courts, and the question is what happens there.
Do you have time for a few more questions?
Yes.
You mentioned the Federalists there. Can you talk about the Federalists and their vision for governance and how this ties into Trumpism?
Yes. Well, the Federal Society has been an extraordinary success story for conservatives. It is heavily funded, And it is a pipeline from law school to a clerkship to a court and ultimately to the Supreme Court. So almost all of Trump's appointees were members of the Federalist Society, and that has been extraordinarily effective. Democrats have nothing equivalent to it. I actually was in Boston last week talking to the American Constitution Society chapters at Boston University and at Northeastern, and I got a good turnout, and I was pleased to talk to them. But they are not the kind of powerhouse the Federalist Society is. So the Federalist Society has been very successful. It claims to have a philosophy of judging, which is originalism and strict constructionism. That is simply a matter of convenience. Many of the decisions that are made by Federalist Society judges violate those principles in the most fundamental ways because that's not what actually governs their decisions. So the Federalist Society is a closed group, ideologically self-contained, and it guarantees advancement for those who choose to join it, and they have successfully packed the federal judiciary.
There was one more thing I wanted to ask you about, and this is related to the book, but I don't think dealt with in the book. There's been a lot in the news lately about this Project 2025 or the Presidential Transition Project. It's led by the Heritage Foundation, and it's done in collaboration with Turning Point USA and other conservative organizations. And I mean, this is like a maximalist version of unitary executive theory being promoted in Project 2025. Can you speak to, if not that specific project, just the ways in which Republicans are pushing for really, outsizing and really growing the strength of executive power over pretty much everything else, it seems like, and calling for just slashing of the DOJ funding, dismantling the FBI. I mean, all kinds of crazy stuff is being pushed right now that seems like it's really designed to dismantle the federal government.
Okay, I think you're right that it is a maximalist program. It's written significantly by Stephen Miller, who was sort of the eminence grise behind much of this. I guess he's not, he is certainly eminent within the group. He's not gray yet, he's actually quite young. What's interesting about it, of course, is that he opines on all sorts of things legal. But he then went to law school and knows very little about the law. And that's part of the reason why many of the Trump initiatives during the first administration failed, because they were legally empty. They were pointless, and they were easily dismantled. And the question is, what will happen during the second term? And of course, this is prognostication. I don't believe that my forecast is any more valid than that of anybody else. I was struck by an article in today's paper that a number of mainstream Republicans are appalled by the fact that some of their party colleagues are calling for a Trump administration that would negotiate with Putin to dismantle and dismember Ukraine and hand over a large part of Ukrainian territory to Russia, thereby confirming that Russia can wield its military power and make gains, and therefore by encouraging China to do the same in the South China Sea and in the Taiwan Straits. What I'm finding encouraging is that there are divisions within the Republican Party, and I would hope to find more of those divisions in the future. I cannot imagine all Republicans voting in favor of dismantling the FBI or defunding the Department of Justice. That's not a conservative position at all. So I think that, as we've seen on the left, and I view myself as on the left, it is also true on the right that the more extreme the positions are, the more difficult it is to get consensus within your group, and there are likely to therefore be splits. We've seen that among some Republican-appointed judges who have defied the party and voted against Trump, and I imagine will do so again. And yet another, these are all just anecdotal, but consider the following anecdote. A large number of highly prestigious lawyers defended Trump in the first impeachment, which was about his call to Zelensky to investigate Biden in exchange for foreign aid, which I think was clearly an impeachable offense. But they nevertheless were willing to defend Trump on that. When Trump went to those lawyers in his second impeachment proceeding, now over January 6th, none of them, not one of them, was willing to represent him. That includes Alan Dershowitz, who has never turned down a client he dislikes and who is happy to reap the fees. People like Dershowitz were pocketing $100,000 a person to file pardon petitions with Trump at the end of the administration. So I think some of the more respected lawyers are thinking twice about going out on a limb and taking weird positions because John Eastman is threatened with disbarment in California. Ken Cheeseborough, Sidney Powell, Lynn Wood. There are lots of lawyers who did these things during the Trump administration and are reaping the consequences of that. And other lawyers may be warned by that not to become accomplices.
Two more things here, real briefly, since you mentioned these figures like Lynn Wood. One thing I find really interesting about this phenomena of Trumpism is, a large part of Trumpism is the conspiracy theories that are thrown out by Trump supporters. What's interesting to me is I think that the people acting conspiratorially is actually, Trump and his inner circle itself. Can you comment on that?
Well, absolutely. I'll make two comments about that. Let's go in different directions because your question raises two very important issues. First of all, Trump's rhetorical strategy is to take every true accusation that is made about him and turn it against his opponents. So he now says Biden is the greatest threat to democracy, and to his discredit, RFK Jr. has lent his name to the same ridiculous statement. He has said it is the Democrats who are subverting justice when it is Trump who subverted justice. He pardoned every one of his cronies after he had gotten his attorney general to displace the U.S. attorneys who were filing the prosecution. So you can't have a more fundamental politicization of the legal system than that. So his strategy is to turn every accusation against his opponent. And of course, that's the Republican strategy as well. I mean, think of the utterly ridiculous and failed efforts to impeach Biden, which are going nowhere, obviously. Okay, so that's one part of it. The second is a conspiracy theory. And it's not, I may be going off on a tangent, but let me start it and then stop, and you can tell me if you want me to continue. Why are these conspiracy theories that Trump and his allies promoting, including, of course, QAnon, why are they being accepted? Do you want me to go on about that? Why do they have an
No,
audience?
I actually am very interested in this topic.
Okay. Well, obviously, this is a big question, and I'm going to start by saying there is no single answer. You've got to give credit to the fact that roughly half the electorate favors Trump over Biden. Not a majority in popular vote terms, but nevertheless, you're talking about roughly 70 million people. You can't give an explanation for the actions of, I can't give one explanation for the actions of 70 million people because there are 70 million different people. But here's how I understand the common thread of all of that. For reasons that I don't fully understand, again, there was something in today's paper about it, Americans are running scared. And I say that that's across the political spectrum. They are anxious, they are disoriented, they are unsettled. They think the country is changing rapidly, and they're not sure they understand where it's going, and they're fearful. I'm fairly confident about that, and I think the polling data confirms that. And there are plenty of reasons for that. People point to the obvious ones, to the pandemic itself, which may be behind us, but there's every reason to think another one is coming down the pike, to the inflation that followed the pandemic, which is now largely controlled, but people don't necessarily see that control in their daily lives, to the fear of job loss from the loss of manufacturing capacity through foreign trade wars. Janet Yellen has just come back from China saying basically, we're going to have to continue talking, but she gained nothing in her efforts to try to normalize trade with China because of changes in technology. And now, especially in artificial intelligence. So people are scared. And of course, the way in which Trump fuels those scares, fuels those fears, and directs them is by making immigration the centerpiece of his campaign. So I live in Los Angeles. I've just been in Boston and New York. I live in very diverse major urban communities. And diversity is what I'm used to. I spent my entire life in diverse communities. But many Americans live in communities where they know everybody face to face, where their parents knew everybody face to face, and their grandparents knew everybody face to face, and there were people who looked like them. And that's changing. It's even changing in their communities, and it's changing in the rest of the country, and it's frightening. When people are frightened, they can do two things. They can become numb and inactive and turn inwards, or they can get angry. And they look for somebody to be angry at and somebody to legitimate their anger. And that really is the statement I'm most confident about. Trump is the angriest man I know. You just look at the expression, his mouth is always turning down in a frown. I try to do it, but I can't imitate it. And he is telling people, you are right to be angry, and I'm going to tell you who and what you should be angry at. Clean the swamp. Get rid of the deep state, and most of all, block immigrants who are destroying our country. So that lends itself easily to conspiracy theories, and it gives simple answers. People want simple answers, but of course, the answers to today's problems are not simple.
No, well, I think that's very true. I mean, I've always said I think that I think there are real criticisms to be made of institutions in America that may need reforming, but I don't think Trump offers that when he says drain the swamp. He's not talking about reform. He's talking about, a complete revolution in how, the US is governed. And I do think there is a difference between wanting reform and wanting what Trump wants.
No, I agree absolutely. When he says drain the swamp, he just wants to put his own alligators there. And we've seen his alligators at work. Members of his cabinet who knew nothing about the subject matter and were utterly incompetent. And most of all, that's why I wrote a whole book about the pandemic, the people that he chose to listen to during the pandemic, people like Scott Atlas, who had no expertise in epidemiology whatsoever, and who said we should everybody should get infected. That's the best way to stop the pandemic. Had we done that, thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe a million more people would have died. So Trump, trusts his gut, and then he finds people who will confirm his trust of his gut, and those are the people he's going to put in power, and that terrifies me.
In closing, for my listeners, I know a lot of people are already burned out, or they feel this burnout over politics and the election. I know a lot of young people that are maybe upset with Biden over foreign policy issues, like there's a wide range of opinions on Israel-Palestine. I'm hearing some people say they don't know who they're going to vote for, or they're uncommitted. What do you want to say to those people that may be listening now? That don't know where they stand, or they have their issues with Biden, even though they don't like Trump. What's your warning to them, or what do you want to say to them?
Yes, I actually definitely do want to talk to them, as I've been talking to radio and audiences across the country over the last couple of weeks, and will continue to do, and as I did to law students in Boston last week. Two things: there are people who, for reasons of conscience, say to themselves, "I cannot vote for Biden," and to them I say, "I can't argue with reasons of conscience." There have been moments when I've had similar conscientious objections. And if that's the way you feel, that's the way you're going to have to act. In that case, make sure to vote in the congressional elections where you don't have those conscientious objections and where you can find candidates whom you can support consistent with your own beliefs. So that's part of it. Secondly, I think it's terribly important that people vote, and not voting is to acquiesce in Trumpism. It really is. I think not to vote is to be complicit in what Trump is going to do in his second term. And I don't think you want to do that. This, to me, is the most consequential election in my 82 years. And it's essential that we have the highest and best informed turnout possible. So that's my advice.
Do you think this ties into that last question in your response? When Trump got in 2016 and those 4 years and everything that has come since, do you think in a way we've got to this dangerous point where Trumpism, I think, has normalized a lot of things that would have been considered extraordinary, 4 to 8 years ago. And I think a lot of Americans aren't being vigilant about that because it's so normalized now. It's so part of the Republican Party that I think people aren't seeing it for how extraordinary it really is and how dangerous it really is. Do you think that's a legitimate concern on my part?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, any one of the many things Trump has done, both as a candidate and in office, would have disqualified any other politician from any party at any time before 2016. That's the extraordinary thing. And you're absolutely right about normalization. Look at the vulgarization of politics. Look at the language that he uses, and now other Republican politicians use as well. And nobody blinks at that. Look at the fact that he lies all the time. The Washington Post made a categorization of those lies. I can't remember the number, but it's in the thousands, and it was several lies a day. The New York Times just wrote an article in today's paper listing the lies in 1 week in January 2024. So people have let down their guard. They are much too credulous about the wild statements that Trump makes. I'll just give you one that I recall from today's paper. Trump said, Biden has said all cars are going to have to be electric within a few years. Biden never said anything of the sort. There's nothing in any in the written record that even remotely looks like that. Yes, Biden is encouraging electrification, which of course every climate anyone concerned about climate change should endorse. But not as a mandatory policy. None of that is happening. But Trump makes these points. It is very much the Nazi political propaganda strategy. You say a lie, and you say it again, and you say it again. And if you repeat it often enough, people think that keep on hearing it, it must be true. So I think people have to revive their critical faculties and go back and check these statements because they're simply not true. They're based on no evidence whatsoever. The central one of which is, I won the 2020 election. He did not win the election. He lost by 7 million votes.
Well, Richard, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. I mean, we could have covered much more ground, probably. This is your books. I mean, this trilogy makes up a lot of words and a lot of pages. So there's a million things we could have gone over. Is there anything I missed that you want listeners to hone in on when they read the books? Or have we covered everything pretty well? And how can my listeners get the books?
Yeah, well, no, I think you have covered it well. Obviously, yes, there's much more that could be said. As I said, I'm writing a fourth book, which won't be out until after the election, but about the six criminal cases, the six cases that are pending against Trump, and much else that's happening in the electoral process. The books are intended to be accessible to anyone. That doesn't mean they're easy reading because there are lots of facts. I crammed them with facts. That's what I'm trying to do, to preserve a record, to deal with the amnesia that has followed the 4 years since the last time Trump was in office. People have to be reminded of what actually happened, but they are readily accessible. There's no technical legal jargon. There's nothing you will have any difficulty understanding, and they're available at all the usual places, local bookstores. On the web from Routledge, the publisher, and of course from Amazon. And they're in paper, I think reasonably priced, and I hope they reach a wide audience.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed the conversations on this episode of the show. As always, if you appreciate the work here, I do at Parallax Views. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. One more time, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. It is you, the listener, that makes this show possible. I only have one other advertiser, the mighty Mike Swanson, but otherwise, this show is entirely listener funded. So head on over to patreon.com/parallaxviews and kick me some cash. And with that being said,
until next time.
You've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.